Strength comes in a variety of forms and can be applied in numerous ways. Today's guest embodies strength in physical pursuits such as triathlons, snowboarding, trail running, and competitive cycling. But it was made clear to me while talking with her colleagues that she also embodies that special kind of inner strength and wisdom which has allowed her to make a definite impact in a long and dedicated career at Microsoft. Hello, I'm Robert Hess, and I'll be your host today as we talk with Rebecca Norlander, technical strategist for Microsoft's chief software architect, Ray Ozzie. I hope you enjoy this chance to look at the technology and the person behind the code. Rebecca graduated from Boston University in 1991, and within a month was working at Microsoft as a software design engineer for Excel. She spent the next 5 years working on various parts of Office before joining the Olay team to work on program management. This became Calm and then Calm Plus before Rebecca moved on to work on Trident, the rendering engine for Internet Explorer, which eventually evolved into Avalon and then the Windows Presentation Foundation. In late 2003, Rebecca was specifically asked to drive the Windows XP Service Pack 2, which would be delivered in less than a year. This work was tightly focused at making aggressive end-to-end enhancements to the operating system, which would add shield-like security technologies to Windows without impacting functionality, performance, or usage. Once XP SP2 was delivered, Rebecca moved on to become the general manager of Windows Vista security team, where she spent 2 years before becoming enlisted to become Ray Ozzie's technical strategist. Recently, Rebecca was awarded the Distinguished Alumni Award by the Computer Science Department of Boston University. More importantly, this annual award had just been established, and Rebecca was unanimously selected as its first recipient. In her own words, Rebecca's driving passion is to change the world for the better through software, services, and technology. Join me now as I welcome today's guest, Rebecca Norlander. Well, thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
Thanks.
I mean, winning that Distinguished Alumni Award sounds like a pretty big honor, especially being the very first one to get it.
Yes, I was very surprised.
Had to wear those big dark robes and stuff like that.
I did. Yeah. It was probably the closest I'll ever get to looking like a PhD candidate or an advanced degree candidate. It was awesome.
So you attended Boston University.
I did.
Prior to that, were you into technology at all?
Yeah, here and there. I was always interested in math and science. I liked English as well. My dad was an engineer, so we spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, just technology, engineering problems, kind of logic problems were his absolute favorite. So I did some computer programming in high school. I really liked it. I hadn't decided to go into computer science from high school. I was going to be a biomedical engineer. But that turned out to be really boring. And so computer science was the most interesting and challenging thing that I found when I got to university, so I went with that.
And what is it that actually keyed you into computers specifically? Was it just because it was more exciting than biological?
Well, it turns out that in biomedical engineering, you don't do anything interesting until you get your PhD. And I thought 8 years of really boring memorization and school was not high on my list. The classes that I liked the most were my programming classes, which were required as part of the engineering school. And I liked computer science because while you had an end goal, you could take different paths to get there. You know, you didn't have to write the exact same code as anybody else in the class, and you could still have a solution. Some were better than others, obviously, and you could optimize around different things. But I liked the creativity that went into it, and I liked the fact that you could write something that looked, you know, slightly human in terms of language, and it would turn into machine code and actually make the computer do something. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty cool.
And so what was that experience like then, your very first time of encountering Microsoft?
Well, I had never been past the Mississippi before I went out for my first interview. And I don't know if they still do this, but back then they send you this nice folder, and it has these pieces of paper that describe the company and what we do and the charter, and the computer on every desktop was the big mantra then. And I open it up, and it starts talking about product management. And so I'm reading through. You know, I had interviewed and done, you know, the standard campus interviews with development questions. So I open this up, and it starts talking about product management and ODMs and OEMs and all kinds of other things, you know, that were marketing focused. And I thought, oh, well, I don't know anything about marketing or product management or how to do any of that. So I'm trying to read the pamphlet, and I'm kind of getting nervous because I'm thinking, well, they're flying me out for a marketing position. That's not really what I had in mind, and I'm not really qualified. So this is a long trip for something that's going to be a colossal waste of time. So by the time I got here, I was like, I walked into the recruiter's office, and I was like, I think maybe you made a mistake. And she said, oh, my goodness, you know, we had a new recruiting assistant, and, he or she sent everybody the same packet. So it just was whatever was at the top of the stack was the thing that went to you. So thank goodness I did not have a product management interview. It was a development interview, and that was more what I was expecting. So that was good because I was trying to understand what a channel was and all these other things where I was like, this is not what I went to school for. So it was kind of an interesting experience. That was my first Microsoft experience.
Now, one thing that I'm assuming is obvious to you is that Microsoft is rather overpopulated with men.
You don't say. I hadn't noticed.
And, you know, being a woman, I mean, what were some of your first thoughts about that sort of situation? And how'd that strike you?
You know, people had talked about it even in university, and I have to admit that up until probably just a couple of years into Microsoft, I lived a little bit in a cloud of oblivion. I knew that there were not that many women, and I was one of the people that started having lunch with other technical women around the company. It was kind of the precursor to Hoppers, which I think is now the Diversity Advisory Council group of women at Microsoft instead of Hoppers. Apparently that was too exclusionary of a name. Okay. Anyway, so, you know, I kind of noticed it, but I didn't really think that much of it initially, and I didn't really see it as a problem or anything else. I just kind of bebopped along in my own little cloud and wrote code and learned stuff and, you know, hung out with my coworkers, and everything was fine. It wasn't until I actually worked for someone who I figured out way later down the road, maybe 18 months of nightmare later, that he didn't like women, actually, and he was going to do everything in his power to make sure that they had a miserable time working for him. And I don't think it was that intentional, but certainly it was a fairly uniform way of treating the women in his group. And so it was then that was I had kind of an eye-opening experience, and I thought, wow, you know, it really does matter. And so one of the things I said is, if I survive this and don't get fired or thrown out on the street, all of which I thought were options, if I survive this, I want to show that it is possible for women to, you know, work at Microsoft, be successful at Microsoft, have good careers at Microsoft. So, you know, I think I said this to you in all of your data gathering beforehand. I have not aspired to be on camera or to be the subject of interviews, but I do so because I think it's important to show that I have been successful, even though I've had lots of missteps and exciting failures from which I've learned a lot. But I've still been successful, and I want to show other women and, you know, underrepresented minorities that there's a great career here, and there's creativity, and there are people that are wonderful to work with, and it's an incredibly fulfilling job and, you know, arena. So I want more of them to enter, since we have such an explosion of things that are going to happen. It's either going to happen outside of Microsoft, which would be a little bit sad, and I think something that we all fear at Microsoft as we watch the announcements from Apple or the things that Google is doing or the excitement around some of the new, you know, this wave of startup things. I want people to know that they can do that here too, and that this is a great place to be, and that it's not just for the geeky white guy.
Mm-hmm. You know, our original mission statement was, you know, computer in every desktop in every home. And that's when we kind of decided, gee, you know, Microsoft can't just be these six buildings back in the forest. Yeah. We need to grow into a bigger company if that's what we want to do. And with your saying that technology is going to explode, we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg right now. In order for technology to be that important, we need everybody to be involved in it, regardless of whether you're a minority or majority or male, female, black, white, whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. The best and the brightest are not just in, you know, one little section of the population. They're across the population.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Diversity. What's your career cycle been like here at Microsoft? Where did you actually start out at?
I started as a developer in Excel, actually. And it was interesting because I had always worked on Unix machines. And when I got here, one of the first things that I had to learn about was the fact that Windows was a 16-bit operating system, and it didn't have a flat memory model. And so there were near, far, and huge pointers. And I thought, what? What is that? So it was a great learning experience. It was also a very large piece of existing code. Of course, now it's even larger. And there were some challenges to understanding how things worked and what the impact of your code was going to have on the overall code base. You couldn't just think, I'm going to write this one little thing and it's going to be great and it's going to be perfect, because you could write one little thing in isolation, but then you had to plug it into a larger mass, and you had to understand what the impact was going to be, and you had to be able to step through other people's code and maybe old esoteric assembly code and still understand what was happening. So it was a fantastic learning forum, and I had some great managers along the way. Andy Lee was my first probably really impactful manager, and he was great at insisting that all of us were able to write great code, but also that we were not afraid to step into other people's code and fix bugs. His team had a reputation for being kind of the best, finish their own bugs and tackle other people's issues as well. And there was a lot of pride around that, of course, competitiveness. But it was a great learning experience. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun.
So you're working on Excel, mm-hmm. and then you moved off to work on other parts of Office, is that
right? I did. I worked on the well-known virus called FindFast, the one of the first incantations of desktop indexing. And it's funny because when
you say well-known virus...
It's not a real virus. It was. It was some people would debate me on that, I think. It was a very idealistic and wonderful little piece of technology that was part of the Office core components. File open, file save, and a bunch of other core components, some printing technologies. And then we had this great desktop indexer, and we had taken some code and a person from Cairo, and they were also writing an indexer. And so we did a bunch of research and tried to understand, the most performant way to go and look through somebody's hard drive and build an index, and what time of day would be the best, and how to make it low priority so it didn't vacuum up all the system resources. And it turns out that no matter how hard you try, it does seem to come up at the wrong time, vacuum up all the system resources, and generally just annoy people and get in the way. I have to say that, as much work as our fabulous desktop search folks have done, they still fall trap to some of the same things that we did for that initial, find fast excitement. It's a hard problem to solve, and while it's a great idea to think that you can, type something into a text box somewhere, a search box somewhere, and find anything on your hard drive or in the cloud, doing that in a performant manner and crawling a drive while somebody's actually using the machine turns out to be a non-trivial problem. Mm-hmm. So I did that for a while. That was when I worked for my most exciting boss, from whom I learned a lot about life, including who not to work for. I also thought I was going to get fired and learned that I could pull myself out of what looked like almost an infinite pit of despair and find a new job that was a better fit and where people valued my skills and where I could continue to learn. And so I always talk about, when I give career talks or advice of any kind, I always talk about, failure is a part of what you'll go through, and you'll be a better person to go through it. It's not going to kill you. You're not going to die because you don't have a good boss and a good situation, and it'll teach you the things to look for in terms of jobs where you'll be successful versus jobs where maybe you won't. And a lot of it had to do with people. Mm-hmm. I like computer science and I like technology because it's computers, and computers don't cry and they're not messy and they don't, get upset with you for things that you don't understand. They're predictable, and if they do something wrong, it's usually because you as the programmer have done something wrong, and I would much rather have that be the case so I could go figure it out than, all the pesky humans. But it turns out that the pesky humans are a big part of your job and of your life, obviously. And picking the right people to work around, even if you don't interface with them every single minute of every single day, is incredibly important. And I didn't know that until I worked for Satan for a little while. That's what I call him. Yeah. And everybody does it. Everybody works for a Satan. And it can be a man or a woman, or it can be somebody that you thought was a friend. It can be somebody that you admired, somebody that's been very successful. Satan's tricky. Takes on lots of forms. Keeps coming back. It's like whack-a-mole. Oh, no! There it is again! So, but you learn and you get through it and you're, you know, you're a better person for it.
Mm-hmm. And there's some other project you work on, Calm?
Yes. Calm+. So, after I left Satan, I went and did performance work for Excel Charting, which was a good way to bounce back. And then an old friend of mine, Nat Brown, called me, and he had gone over to the Olay team. And he called me, and he said, you have to come over here and work on this stuff. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, you remember when he worked in Publisher and I worked in Excel, and we worked on Olay? And Olay was, you know, great concept, very cool, very interesting technology, lots of potential.
Really, a groundbreaking concept.
It really was very difficult to use, and often the, you know, the code and what it did not match the documentation and what it said it was going to do, and usually it was because, you know, there were always good reasons. They had gotten into something and figured out that, oh, well, that's not going to work at all. So they changed it, but there was never a reflection of
documentation.
Who writes comments in code or writes documentation? So we would run down the hall and go ask the you know, Bob Atkinson and Tony Williams and those guys, and, hey, it doesn't really work this way. How's it supposed to work? And so it was a great experience, and I worked with Nat a lot in that time, and Nat and I used to have these idealistic, frothing conversations about, oh, how good it could be if only Olay was a lot easier to use, and it could be such a mecca for developers, and we could get people to write all kinds of programs on top of Windows and think of the things that people would invent or come up with if they had this just a little bit of an easier time with Olay. And so he said, you know, why don't you come over and help me fix Olay? I think those were his exact words. And I was like, right on! You know, idealism at its highest, which still exists inside me, I have to admit. And so I went over to fix Olay. And so we worked on, we soon changed it to be called Calm and Decom. And I did stuff with Calm and Decom on Windows and on the Mac. And then it became Calm Plus, and I worked on that for a while. And it was an interesting experience. It's hard to fix, really. You know, the concepts are very complicated, still very necessary, but we also had a shift in technology over time. You know, we went from 16-bit to 32-bit, so the problem space has changed, and I don't know that the code or the thinking always kept up with some of the other changes that we had. So it got a little embroiled, and I decided it was time to go do something else.
And that's what, you know, seeing that a lot of the work put into that eventually evolved into the .NET technology we have today, which shows that you were actually right, is that if Olay could be made easier to program with, it would be far better for people to use.
Yes, absolutely. And so the folks in .NET and all the folks that have worked on the precursor technologies should feel great, and they should feel like, ha, we were right. Perseverance. And the other interesting thing is to think about how long it takes to get something like that right. And so as we embark on additional, you know, gigantic problem spaces, we should not let ourselves get so caught up in internet time and understand that some of these things are going to take a while to get right.
Mm-hmm. So then after the Calm, Calm Plus, Decom stuff, you then worked on for Trident, right?
Yep.
And how was that?
It was fun. It was my first foray into management. I went over to be a lead program manager on the Trident team, which was essentially the rendering engine and then became the object model for Internet Explorer.
So how did the talk end up going off being programming and becoming management?
Well, that was actually Nat's doing. When I left Excel Charting and I went to the Olay team, I went from being a developer to a program manager. And honestly, it was a bit of a hard sell because the program managers that I had worked with in the office group were great at, you know, user experience design and things that I honestly thought were important but wasn't interested in personally and, quite frankly, wasn't that good at. And so when Nat came over, you know, when Nat said, come on over and be a program manager, you know, and he was a program manager, I was like, well, I'm not really sure. You know, like, I like writing code, and I do think it's important to, you know, fix Olay, but I'm not sure that I want to do user experience design. And that was my first understanding that program management was a very, you know, you can say that program management can be summed up as people who get stuff done. And you can choose then how you want to apply that. You can be a user experience person, or you can be more focused on how to actually create technology for developers or for the system itself. So you can still be very technical. And as a program manager in Olay, certainly we had to write lots of sample code to show people how to use the technology that we were putting together. But it was different than being than writing the production code. Mm-hmm. So when I, you know, after I had done that for a while, I thought, oh, this is pretty cool. You know, I'm having a greater impact in a way because I'm able to show a ton more people how to write code that's going to go and you know, do something in the world. So when I went over to Trident, the goal was the same. It was just the internet platform, kind of the, we're going to shove this rendering technology into the internet platform. But the goal was still to get a lot of people to write code on top of Internet Explorer, which ultimately became wildly successful. Certainly not because I moved over there, but because people had this vision that there was going to be a way that you could write easy programs in the browser. You know, even HTML with a little script was considered a program, and people were calling themselves developers, which of course made all of the real developers very upset. And this is where I was a little bit of a heretic because I thought, well, heck, I don't really care what tools they want to use. I want them to create great experiences and push technology forward. And if they don't want to learn, you know, they don't want to start by assembling their own motherboards, then I'm okay with that. You know, there's certainly a place for those folks, but that's a finite amount of space. And if we are going to have this explosion of technology, it's not all going to be kind of to the metal programming. So if I can invite more people to participate and bring their ideas and bring their creativity, they're not the ones that are going to write the next operating system, but they might come up with a new way of thinking about computing that's going to push us forward. And I think that's where, you know, a lot of the social computing came out of that. Mm-hmm. It was people's need to combine the internet and the tools that they had with the fact that they wanted to have a life and they wanted to communicate with their friends.
So then after working on Trident, you then moved on to Windows XP SP2 or Service Pack 2, as you like calling it.
Yes.
Now, before we dive into that too far, preparing for this, I actually had a chance to talk to some of your colleagues, and one of the colleagues had some interesting story to
mention. Yeah, I know what
mention.
Colleague is coming up.
So,
just think, he's up next, so I can't wait to see what he has to say, because I get to go next for him.
So let's see what he has to say about you.
All right.
As XPSP2 got off the ground, and Rebecca was transitioning from her old job in Avalon over to running the XPSP2 project, there were a lot of things running around that had to be kept track of, and she was in a different building at the time, and it was very inconvenient. So I had a reasonably large office in Building 40 at the time, and one day she showed up with a bunch of stuff, her laptop and a couple of personal items, and said, "I'm taking over your table." I said, "Okay." It's actually the first time I've been doubled up since I started in 89. And we doubled up pretty well for a while.
So one of the things that struck me about that, and we haven't really touched on it totally here yet, is that you actually do have this kind of in-your-face attitude sometimes, and you kind of let people know what you think.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not... A lot of people talk about inside voice and outside voice, and I think it took me... I'm not sure how long it took me, because I'm not sure I've learned just yet when things should be inside voice and when things should be outside voice. I think I've gotten better, but yes, a lot of things that occur in my head, and I think this is probably pretty common in the folks that are gravitating towards computer science, at least it has been in my experience, things that come into my head come on out of my mouth, and there's not a lot of, you know, filtering. So I remember talking to somebody about this at some point, and he was actually asking me for advice, and I thought, I'm the wrong person to ask. But I have actually picked up a bunch of tricks, and one of them is I always have a water bottle with me because I always drink water. And when people are talking, if I can feel the urge to say something rising up in a way that seems somewhat uncontrollable, I'll drink some water, because that'll give me at least a few minutes. It's going to come out, but maybe I can morph it into something that's less offensive instead of whatever exactly occurred in my mind. And I can try and be a little empathetic and put myself in their shoes and say it in a way that maybe they'll hear. So the out loud and inside-outside voice... it's all outside for me.
So I'll remember that in the future, then, if I find you drinking a lot of water around me, that there's something you're not telling me.
Either that, or we're under really bright lights and I feel like I'm going to spontaneously combust. That's the other reason I'll drink a lot of water.
So Windows XP SP2.
Yeah.
What was that all about?
Well, at the time, Microsoft was just on fire. And I don't mean that in a positive way. We were being we were under attack, essentially, by hackers around the world, and we were costing our, especially our enterprise businesses, a lot of money because we had these vulnerabilities, as we came to call them. So a bunch of executives got together, and they were kind of pulling their hair out. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And they said, well, you know, we really need to have a release of Windows that fixes all of this. And remember, there's a bunch of people that, you know, for them it's the silver bullet and the final solution. And I will say that for security, there is no 100% solution outside of, you know, for a computer, you can turn it off. For you personally, in terms of being secure, you can be dead. That's when you're completely secure. Nothing else is going to happen to you, or if it does, it doesn't matter. So security is, it doesn't, you're dead, you don't care. Security is something that is an interesting field because it never goes away. It's like the never-ending chess game. It's clever, it's interesting, it changes based on the landscape that you're in, but there's no silver bullet solution. There are things and practices that you can do to be better. There is better ways to write code, and there are better ways to design code, but there's no solution, you know. So when people started saying, well, we need to have a version of Windows that's going to fix the problem, I was always like, oh, don't get me near that.
That's when you start drinking water, right?
Exactly. Oh, no, I was still in Avalon at the time, and I was hearing the rumors, and we were doing some brainstorming, and we called it, you know, Sledgehammer. We're going to have like a 6-week release with all these things fixed. And they'd think of all these ideas, and I was like, oh, I'm going to. I had to, you know, have people from my team go because they were part of Windows, and I thought, oh, I'm going to avoid that like the plague. And then Brian Valentine and I were having some conversations, bizarrely, about diversity, because he's like, why are there no women in Windows? And I said, well, you know, when you think about, so here's Sledgehammer going on over here, that's what we had called it initially. Springboard was the more positive name that they applied to it. And then Brian and I were having these kind of bizarre conversations over lunch where he said, you know, why aren't there any women here? And I said, well, you know, there's a lot of different reasons. Some of it's cultural, but, you know, we'll change that over time. But some of it is just that when you think of somebody for a new job, you know, you think of your list of buddies, the people that you like to hang out with, and turns out that most of those people probably look like you, and you've worked with them for a long time, and it's the same old, same old. So, you know, the next time you have a big job come up, you know, cast a wider net. Figure out how to cast a wider net. And he's like, well, I don't know how to do that, you know. And I said, well, you can call me if you want some suggestions for people that can do different jobs. So about 2 weeks later, you know, Microsoft is still on fire. I'm thinking about going on vacation. Lots of vulnerabilities are popping up, and we're in the news. And I get this phone call from Brian, and literally it's the day before I'm going on vacation. And I thought it was a little weird because I didn't know that Brian had my cell phone number. That should have been my first indication, because at the time it was not in the address book. And I said, hey, Brian, what's up? And he said, where are you? And I said, well, actually, I'm standing outside of the liquor store getting ready to prepare for my vacation. Now that you ask. And he said, well, I want to talk to you about something. And I said, okay. And he said, I have an offer that you can't refuse. And I thought, oh, no, this isn't good. And I said, okay, can it wait till I get back from vacation? And he said, well, why don't you come talk to me about it before you go on vacation? Because I really need an answer today. And I said, well, if it's an offer I can't refuse, why don't you just say that I said yes, and I'll come back and talk to you about it later. And I did drive back to work and talk to him about it. And he told me that they wanted to formalize the Springboard efforts, and that they knew that they weren't going to be able to do something in a 6-week period. Actually, that was not totally true. I think Jim still believed that we could do something in maybe a 2-month period. But Brian said, you know, we need somebody who's going to lead it. And I thought of you. And I thought, oh, I had to have that conversation with him. And I was like, and here I had been saying, hee hee, not my problem. I'll send some people to work on it. And now I was like, now it's my problem. And he said, so what do you need? And I said, well, I certainly can't do it alone. So I'm going to give you a list of people that I think are going to be most helpful to me, and I need you to get them for me, and we'll work together on this project. And I said, I need a release manager, because I'm not a release manager. And so he freed up Todd Wonky, and I said, I want Richard Ward, since he is an architect in the security team and has a mature approach to looking at problems and is also knowledgeable in the security space and has good credibility with Windows. And I need a couple of program managers who are going to really help us think about what we're doing and make sure that we're focused in a particular direction and have our eyes on the the goal, because you want a short-term release that's going to please OEMs, that has to get on machines in the right time frame, and that's going to make our customers happy. So I also picked up Ryan Burkhardt and Lori Litwack, and there were a couple other people on the team, but that was kind of the core of people that drove SP2. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the hardest jobs I ever had. It was part technology. You know, we did think about what are the shield-like technologies instead of the one-off bugs. Let's look for trends and think about applying shields and multiple layers of shields. So even if the hacker, so to speak, breaks through one level of protection, there is another level below it instead of one breakthrough allows you to own the machine. So there was that to manage, and then there was the fact that I had always tried to kind of skate under the radar in terms of the executives. Turns out that's not a great career move, but it was fine in terms of getting a lot of things done. And so all of a sudden, there were about 13, I think, executives that I had to juggle at any one time. They all thought they were in charge, and they all thought
Little did they know.
No, actually, I really wasn't. They all thought they were in charge, and I had to let them believe that they were in charge, but also kind of, you know, continue to apply the constraints of the problem. Here's the timeline that we have. Here's the problem that we have. This is not a release of Windows that is going to solve everybody's problem, nor is it a train that everybody can hook onto. If it's not security related, you know, I'm not interested in having the discussion. And I had good sponsorship from Jim and from Brian and from Mike Nash, who was my boss, because he was leading up the new security business unit. That we put together to both deal with the technology side and then also the marketing, PR, and business side to try and work with our customers to redevelop the trust relationship with them, which was just as important as the technology. And so we galloped along for 11 months and got a really great release of Windows out. But it was hard. It was hard technically. It was hard management-wise. It was a lot of hard work and a lot of long hours.
So then from SP2, which was security related, you then went on to actually focus on Vista security.
Yes, I did.
How was that different?
somebody laughed in the background. That was so mean. how is that different? Wow. You know, honestly, I think Vista wasn't as focused. And part of that is a natural thing. It's an entire release of Windows, and we hadn't released Windows in a while, so there were a lot of things that people wanted to put into it.
They couldn't party on SP2, sticking a ton of stuff in that, so they just held off and said, the next version of Windows, we'll take and get all of our technologies and stuff.
Absolutely. So, you know, and since it had been a while, people were panicked about, well, you know, when we finally do release a new version of Windows, it better be good and it better be big in terms of the number of features and the number of things in it. So there was a lot of focus on trying to put more things in it, even from a security perspective. You know, we had done SP2, but there were plenty of things that people wanted to get in. You know, I guess lots of times people talk about boiling the ocean, and I think Vista, too, a little bit was boiling the ocean. And certainly the team, when I arrived, had a lot of things going on. And while I agree that a full release of Windows has to have more features and more things in it, in general, than a service pack release, I still think you need focus to successfully drive an engineering team. So one of the first things that I did was work with the team that I was managing and create some focus around a set of things that we would do for Vista. I'm a big believer in doing fewer things really well than a lot of things not as well. And so that was kind of the mantra. And it was hard to stick to, because if the people all around you are doing a lot of things and not necessarily picking the 3 to 5 things that they want to do really well, then the pressure from both executive management and your peer groups and everything else is pretty high. So unlike SP2, where I had a list of things, these are the things that can get into the product, this is the list of questions I'm going to ask you no matter who you are, about whether whether we'll let the things, your technologies or your ideas into SP2, you didn't have that for Vista as much. Sure, there were a set of things that we wanted to do, but it was a much longer list. And people are creative. They can wedge almost anything in a longer list. So if I've got 3 things, it's hard to wedge something else in. But if I've got 25 things, almost any idea I can come up with, I can morph into one of those 25 things. So I think for me, that was the biggest difference, just trying to get a relatively young team full of talent to ship their first big release of a product and stay focused and feel like they were doing the right thing even when they had to say no a lot to other people. Mm-hmm. That's a big difference. Mm-hmm.
So what exactly is your current job?
So the internal title is technical assistant to Ray Ozzie. You know, Bill Gates, as you know, CEO, chairman, and chief software architect, has had a technical assistant for a long time. And the job of that person really varies depending on who that person is and what Bill needs at the time. A lot of other executives along the way have picked up the notion of having a technical assistant as well. And it's a really difficult job to describe because it's very dependent on the person that you work for. Some people are, you know, essentially technical researchers. They, you know, your executive might ask you to go off and think about something or research something or get information about what a product team is doing or technology outside, and your job is to go get the information and distill it into something that's not going to take them 2 weeks to read, where they can get a competent understanding of a new technology or a, you know, the architecture of something that a new that a product group is doing in a short amount of time, the executive summary, so to speak. So it is a staff job, and I had never actually been all that interested in being a TA. I like to ship product, and I like to work on a product, and I get a lot of personal satisfaction after moving something forward and shipping a technology and, you know, kind of creating something for people and hopefully, you know, making the world a better place. So being in a staff role, I was like, I don't know. But we were at the end of Vista, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do next, and I had a series of one-on-ones with Ray, and I had no idea that he thought being that I would be his a good technical assistant for him. We talked about the things that he was doing, different technologies, our philosophies on what where we were from a computer science and technology standpoint in the world, how we wanted to see people using technology, what we thought it could do, people inside, you know, the landscape that is Microsoft, because as a new person, he was just overwhelmed and surprised by some of the things that you see on the inside. And I was like, that's old hat. Here's what that really means. And he asked me about different people that I had worked with who he was either hiring or helping to put into strategic jobs around the company. And I would give him kind of the, you know, things I think they're good at, things I think they could work on, and the job that I think they'd be good at, in my own opinion. I had decided I would go in almost unfiltered. You know, I wasn't going to be rude, but I thought, well, if he wants to meet with me, then I'm just going to give it to him straight. If he asks
without
me,
your water bottle?
Without the water bottle.
Yeah.
If he asks me a question, I'm going to answer it. So at some point, we'd talked through a bunch of people that he was trying to hire. And at the very end of this conversation, which ran over again, every conversation went long because we enjoyed talking to each other, he said, you know, one more thing. And, you know, we both were going, we really have to go. He said, one more thing. He said, I think I need a technical assistant. And I said, well, all right, what are you looking for? And he said, well, you know, I want somebody who's, you know, technically savvy, who has some good experience in different types of technology at the company. I want somebody who's been here for a while and knows the landscape and knows a lot of the people and the players. You know, I want somebody who's, you know, who I get along with, who I have a you know, personality match with, and that I can trust pretty immediately, and most of all, I want somebody whose core values are very similar to mine. And I looked at him and I thought, well, I had a list of people for you, because I thought he was asking me for suggestions. I said, I had a list of people for you until I got to that last one, and then it gets a little harder. Because he does have a very strong set of core values, not all of which are common. It's not good, bad, or other. It's just he's got his own set of core values, which I like and I admire and are frighteningly similar to mine. So he says all this, and I think, I sit there for a few minutes, and I was like, you know, I'm going to have to think about that for a while because I don't have any names that are coming to mind. So I'm really going to have to kind of go through my mental Rolodex and look through. I might even have to bring up the address book or something and kind of cruise through and see who kind of stands out. So I'll let you know. And he's like, no, that's not what I meant. And I was like, I meant you. Are you interested in being my technical assistant? And I am rarely at a loss for words. And I think my response was, and I think I just kind of stood there for a few minutes with my mouth hanging open, you know, just, I'm sure looking like the very picture of a qualified technical assistant going, And I said, wow, I don't know what my answer is. I said, I realize that almost every person on the planet would jump at the opportunity, but, you know, I had some personal goals that I wanted to achieve in my next job, and being somebody's staff was not on my list. And I said, you know, that means the job is all about you. And honestly, I felt like I wanted a job that was a little bit more autonomous for me, where I could, you know, go back to driving technology. And he said, well, that's fair. Why don't you think about it a little bit? And I said, all right. And so he said, we'll exchange some emails and let me know what your questions are. So I thought about it, and I thought, well, maybe. And I was trying to figure out what I would do in Windows, or if I wanted to go somewhere else. And about a week later, there was this announcement. And they said, you know, Bill Gates in 2 years is stepping down, and this new guy, Ray Ozzie, is going to be the chief software architect. And my first thought was, oh, I better phone him up. It's kind of like...
Because the first time here, Ray was just simply working at Microsoft.
Yeah, he was smart, and he was clearly going to... Maybe he was being called CTO, and... You know, he's clearly going to go somewhere and take a big job. And I was like, whoa! You know, so it was kind of like the analogy I give people, which is, well, who cares? The analogy I give people is when you're in high school, or when I was in high school, this is going to say a lot about what happened in my high school, I had lots of friends, you know, girls and guys. And, you know, it would be like if one of my close guy friends who had the world's most beautiful girlfriend, you know, she was in a coma. Something had happened to her, and they weren't going to be able to go to senior prom. And, well, you only get one senior prom. And so, you know, one day the guy would say, well, hey, you know, my girlfriend's in a coma, but I'd like to go to the senior prom. So do you want to go to the senior prom? You know, just as friends, we'll hang out. And you say, yeah, sure, that'd be great, because I don't have a date anyway. So I might as well, you know, sign up to go to the senior prom with you, because at least we'll have a good time. We have something to talk about. And then, like, a week before the prom, the girlfriend comes out of the coma miraculously. She can walk around. She's great. Everything's good. And you're like, ooh, I got to call him. I got to give him the easy out. I got to let him off the hook and tell him, you know, you should really go. You should really go with the girlfriend. And so when Ray was announced as the new chief software architect, I was like, I got to give him the easy out. I got to figure out a way to say, well, now that you have a real job, maybe you should find a real TA. And then I thought, you know, I said this to one of my friends, and she looked at me and she's like, seriously? And I was like, yeah, dude, I gotta figure it out. Like, this is ridiculous. I can't go do that job. And she said, okay, so do you think that Bill and Steve woke up on Monday, because I think they announced on a Tuesday, do you think they woke up yesterday and said, I know, we'll get Ray to do it? She's like, this has been in the works for years, probably part of the goal of bringing him to the company altogether. She's like, this is only a surprise to you. When he asked you to be his TA last week, he knew. He knew what his new job was going to be, and he was asking you to participate. And I was like, oh, it's a good thing I didn't call him. And then I thought, okay, well, so that's interesting. You know, there were a lot of things that I wasn't sure I'd like about being a TA, but I thought, well, heck, you know, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Famous last words, how bad could it be? Turns out it wasn't that bad, thank goodness. But I thought, you know, how bad could it be? Which is always the thing that I say to myself. Even if I make a mistake, if I'm making a decision, if I'm doing whatever, my question is always, how bad can it be? And you can always, if you hate your job or if you make a wrong decision, you can always go back and do something else. So I thought, well, heck, all right, I'll try it out. So I did. So that's how I got to be Ray's technical assistant. I do call it technical strategist outside of Microsoft because two things. Nobody knows what a technical assistant is outside of Microsoft. And if I tell them I'm a technical assistant, they immediately assume that that's some kind of administrative role.
Some glorified secretary or something like that.
Yes, and I would be a horrendous administrative assistant of any kind. I would get fired within a week, I'm quite sure. So I don't want people to think that that's the role that I'm playing, so I call myself technical strategist.
That sounds like a great title to me. I think you could get changed in the address book.
Yes, yeah. I'll work on that sometime.
So now with one of your core values being wanting to bring about a change in technology for people, do you think you've accomplished that in your current job?
That's a hard one. I think my answer would have to be no, but here's the thing I learned about the job that I'm in now. The things that you do as a technical assistant, you know, if I look at Calm and Olay and when that actually came to fruition in .NET in a large scale way, the things that you do as a TA are similarly long term. And it's even harder to recognize than something like Calm and how that participated in creating .NET, because it's usually conversations, whether they're technical or otherwise, that you have with people who are leading teams of folks, who are leading, you know, divisions even. So you spend time with your, you know, with your manager, in my case, Ray, and then people around the company, and your role is to influence and to translate and to advise and to, you know, kind of provide different perspective. And seeing the fruits of that takes so much longer. You know, unlike in a product team where at least people are writing code and you can see if stuff is starting to work or not, when you have, you know, spent an afternoon just kind of going through an architectural diagram and then you don't hear back from the team for 3, 6, or 9 months, you know, have you accomplished anything? And so what happens is you'll get to the point where you're feeling somewhat bad about yourself and, you know, thinking that maybe you should do something else. And then you'll go to some kind of offsite and somebody that you spoke with will get up and give a presentation that clearly, you know, whether they give you credit, it doesn't make any difference if you get credit, but clearly the thinking and the ideas and the discussions that you had with them, you know, led them in a particular direction, and they've gone on and created a strategy and a set of, you know, technologies or worked on an architecture, and that now they're saying that as the thing that they're going to go do. And so so while it feels like no, because it's harder to measure and I don't have a technology or code or anything that I can kind of, you know, conceptually wrap my hands around, other people would probably say yes, and I probably won't understand the impact that I made until after I'm gone from the job. So
I mean, you're planting seeds right now to a certain extent.
And yeah, they take a long time.
Yes. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, you've learned a lot, you've grown a lot, and you're well respected throughout the company. And as a matter of fact, I talked to one of your current colleagues about some of his thoughts about working with you and some of his impressions of how you were in that whole process. So let's take a look at this clip right now from Mark to see what he had to say about you.
The thing that I've noticed about Rebecca, just doing her job and how she is as a person, she enters a room more quietly than she leaves. She's a very unassuming person when she comes in. And after you spend some time with her in a meeting or a setting, you know, number one, she's a formidable, wicked, smart intellect. Right? She's a talented, technical person. And the other thing you notice is that you kind of like her when she walks out of the room. She's not afraid to speak her mind. She's not afraid to stop and listen to somebody else's mind when they're talking. That's a talent and it's a skill that she has, and she brings to a lot of the things that she does.
And for the most part, that mimics everything else that everyone said about you, is you know, really enjoying working with you and the fact that you actually can make a difference in the meetings and stuff like that.
Then I gave you the right list of people. That's great.
Or you paid them off ahead of time.
Exactly.
So enough about work. What do you do outside of work? What makes Rebecca forget about technology?
I try to be active. You know, I'm not a big let's go to the pro club and spend 45 minutes on the stair stepper. I like to go out and run, even when it's raining, which is good because it's been raining a lot. I love to ride my bike. My favorite thing to do is actually ride my bike, road bike. I'm a terrible mountain biker. I try it occasionally, and it typically makes me want to throw my bike down the mountain, which is not that good because it takes a long time to go get it when you've thrown it down the mountain. And everybody else gets really annoyed with you. But on my road bike, you know, it's the closest that you can come to flying in my mind. You know, you feel weightless and you feel fast even if you're not that fast. And you're going somewhere under your own power, and you can bike hard enough to forget whatever is on your mind, whether it's work stuff or personal stuff or anything else. It's an incredibly freeing feeling.
Essentially, that is your meditation.
It is. Yeah. It is.
Here's the part of the show where we ask you some specific questions. We ask all of our guests these exact same questions, just kind of, you know, figure out where you're at and what you have to say. The first question is, what advice do you have for people in your field?
What advice? I think the number one thing is to have fun. Computers and technology is fun, and if it isn't fun for you, then you could be in the wrong place. So have fun. Stay current. You know, be excited about exploring what's new, even if it's outside of the realm of your expertise, be creative. Look to the future. Figure out. Feel like you can experiment. That's what this is all about. We're not, sitting at an operating table. We're not cutting open people's organs or anything. It's a computer. And so while it's on your desk or in the sky, before you roll it out to other people to use, experiment. See what's going to work and what doesn't.
Okay. And next, how would you describe your work to someone who is not technical?
I wouldn't.
Do you know anybody that's not technical?
Yes, I do. And usually I tell them I work at Microsoft, and everybody says, oh. And then they ask if I know various executives. So then I don't have to describe my job at all because they're too fascinated with that part. If I have to describe it, it kind of depends. My current job, I basically say, well, I'm a technical strategist, and that means I do some, technical research, and I do some, I'm a proxy or a go-between. Sometimes I show up instead of my boss, and I work with teams on certain technical problems, or I have one-on-ones with folks. And then I'm kind of his cultural attaché to help him understand how the company works and what people are really saying instead of, the direct translation of the words that are coming out of their mouths. So that's how I describe my current job. It kind of depends on the job that I'm in. Sometimes I say I'm an engineering manager because people more or less have a picture of what that means if I'm managing people. Other times, if I'm doing more IC-type work, I say that I design technology. I won't necessarily say architect because that means a lot of different things to people. So those are kind of the big paintbrushes that I'll use for that.
Okay. The next, in life, what would you compare to producing software?
Wow. In life, what would I compare to producing software? Geez. I guess growing things. I'm sure some people will say birthing things, but I haven't done that, so I can't compare. but growing things where you, an idea is a little bit like a seed. If you do nothing with it, it doesn't go anywhere. If you plant it and you water it and you take care of it and you treat it for disease or, get rid of bugs, all kinds of other things, then eventually you have, something you can use, whether it's something you can use for beauty or something that you can use for food or whatever. There's a lot of different things. You can find analogous ways to look at a lot of different industries, even the car industry or, the steel industry or, some of the more mechanical industries are similar in many ways. They have their own constraints that are different from ours, but a lot of the kind of the core practices aren't that different.
Okay. Now, finish the sentence. You know you're a computer nerd when?
When you're more interested in understanding how the computer graphics worked in, say, Indiana Jones than you are in the actual scene that you're watching.
And you found yourself thinking that?
Well, I haven't seen Indiana Jones yet, but I do spend a lot of time, when I see something that's really amazing, that's computer graphics or that's clearly technology-driven, I spend a lot of time, everybody's going, ooh, ah, and I'm like, I wonder how they did that. So, maybe I'm not actually a geek.
Okay. Now, lastly, here you're going to kind of express some of your inner creativity. We ask everyone to draw their favorite data structure, and then make sure you sign your name.
Okay. Can I draw it?
And make sure you explain it to us, too.
Oh,
so it's
I will.
Like, can't just be some sort of...
Well, let me draw it, and then okay. I'll turn it around for people.
And, even though this is a technology kind of show, we make people do this with a pen and paper rather than a computer screen and things like that. It's a little bit different. The best one yet, I think.
Okay, so this is really, really dorky. You want to hold that up? Okay, so I drew an array. And it says, because with Bill leaving, we need array. Very, very bad pun, but there you go.
So is that just sucking up to your boss?
No. That's because I thought it was so incredibly cheesy that it was funny. And it was an easy data structure to actually put on a piece of paper on camera. You know, I thought of all these things, and every time I would think about the question, because they do let you know that that's a question that they're going to ask, I thought, oh, I don't know, what am I going to draw? Well, a data structure itself is kind of boring, so I'd want to put it in the middle of something. And so it would get more and more complex, and I thought, good heavens, you know, if I can manage to hold a pen without looking like I have some kind of palsy, I'll be amazed. And so I thought, no, I gotta make something more simple than that. So yeah, that was the simple one.
Well, before we go any further, Brekka, let's go ahead and have you sign your wonderful data diagram here. And now let's see if we have any questions from the audience. Here's a question here.
Yes, with XPSP2, you had mentioned there were roughly 13 executives involved. Were there ever any competing agendas that came up there? Any memorable ones? And how were those ultimately resolved?
Here's a glass of water if you need it.
I don't think there's enough water for this one. The answer is yes. You know, 13 people are always going to have a set of things, you know, a set of conflicts. It doesn't matter if they're all friends or not. And 13 executives who own different pieces of the business and have different priorities, at least in their own minds often, are naturally going to have conflict. I think some of the most notable conflicts were around something that did, some of the fundamentals of it did sneak into SP2, which was changes that we made for Windows Starter Edition. Those were probably some of the biggest discussions and some of the hardest discussions. Some of the code changes were fairly extensive, and I was really worried, and it came in late in the cycle, and I was very concerned about the impact that it would have on the product and if we would find more bugs, if we would create instability that would mean that we would slip because we were running tight to the wire. So there were some business reasons that the executives got together and decided that some pieces of Starter Edition were important to get into SP2. And so that meant that both the team of people that were working on Starter Edition and the SP2 team, put in even more hours to make sure that that code converged and came together. Most of the other, I don't remember a lot of the other specifics because most of the other things didn't get in. We were pretty effective at saying, if your feature or your great idea doesn't have anything to do with security and isn't tangibly going to improve security for our customers, then we're not interested in putting it in the release. And even though people would gripe and they would try and they would push and they might manipulate a little bit, at the end of the day, the problem was so public and so visible that no one could deny that that should be the high order bit. So for the most part, it was, while there were arguments, most of them were fairly easy to resolve. And like I said, you know, I got good backing from Jim and from Brian and from Mike Nash. And so there was only the Starter Edition that people thought was a high enough priority that we were willing to take some risk for that. That was the big one that I remember.
Thank you, Rebecca, from the Technical Community Network, for being our guest today. And thanks to all of you in the audience for coming.